Welcome to Nexus 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. This episode of Nexus 818 Podcast features the Montford Point Marines. After 144 years of exclusion due to segregation, approximately 20,000 African American men were admitted to the U.S. Marine Corps. For their valiant service to our nation, these Marines were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in November of 2011. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out episode 27 from October the 4th of 2023 to learn about the background of the Montford Point Marines. I'm pleased to welcome to episode 40 the descendants of Sergeant Major William E. Tenney, who served in the Montford Point Marines. My guests tonight are Lorna Johnson, Danelle Radney, Alyssa Joy Miller, and Brielle Johnson, daughter and granddaughters of Sergeant Major William Tenney. Welcome, Lorna, Danelle, Alyssa, and Brielle.
Well, thank you.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
So I'd like to start with a few interesting facts. First, William was born in Bath, Maine, and his family was the only Black family in the town until the 1970s.
Yes.
We'll talk more about that. Second, he served 30 years in the Marine Corps and was stationed in Japan during World War II. He was in Vietnam and in Korea.
Yes.
And third, his only child was a 100-meter hurdler and pentathlete during the famous 1972 Munich Olympics. So, interesting family background. So let's talk about William. He was born in Bath, Maine in 1926.
Yes.
So growing up in Maine as the only Black family must have been a unique challenge. Lorna, you told me that William was raised in a white culture. What did he tell you about that and his experiences?
It was just a matter of fact. He didn't really talk much about his family. Matter of fact, it wasn't until after he was retired did I even begin to get some pictures of he and his sisters. And I never met my grandparents on his side. And to see pictures of them. But the amazing part to me is that they were a well-loved family. To this day, there is Michael Fish and there's Directory. So it was fascinating that this family, it was well-respected and beloved. His father was one who owned a shoe repair shop. And according to the directories in the 40s, during even the before the Depression, he owned in several different places shoe shops, as well as I found out that my art ability and even my dad's, in a newspaper article, it talks about that this George Tenney, my dad's father, was not only this well-known shoe repair, but also a oil painter.
Do you have any of his paintings anywhere?
Nope, not at all.
But she is an artist, and there are beautiful like drawings and paintings that she's done throughout the years, plastered over the walls and her home and our home. So definitely lots of talent there.
Okay.
The also amazing part is my dad has his Bath, Maine High School. It was called Morris High School. And in 1945, he was elected the president of the freshman class. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, in the rest of the country, there definitely no Black, no dark-skinned man even was going to be a president of an all-white school in basically a white city. So... So it's just fascinating. And then his mother worked for the governor, Sewall, and there and helped raise the son. So it's just fascinating. They have her down as a seamstress in the directory, or that they have records of him.
So how old was he when he enlisted?
He enlisted in, I have it here for me to make sure I get the things right. He enlisted in 1948, and he was
Okay.
born in 26. So one of my girls.
He's 18.
So yeah.
Okay.
And the amazing part is he never finished high school, and mainly because his father died. There's five siblings in the family. So his father died. The oldest boy, who also was the president in his class, died, I think, as a senior. And so he felt this obligation to begin to care for the family and provide. So he dropped out of school and ended up working that before he just before he went into the service, it was the shipyard there. And that so in Bath, Maine, that's one of the prominent shipyards there even today.
And this would have been coming right out of the Great Depression, right, Mom? So do you think there was maybe pressure on him as an 18-year-old man to be kind of helping climb out of the, I don't know the right word for it, but wasn't there a business collapse during the Depression and then death in the family? So it makes sense that he would be kind of picking up the pieces.
And so, he was a very principled man, and he was a man that family was important to him, and he cared for family. He was committed to take care of family. So, I mean, even through the years, he not only as he went into the service, but he made sure and bought a home for his mother. And then as she passed and then had it passed down to one of the sisters, Aunt Maxine, which was the only one that I met before he retired. He brought me up to Bath, Maine, and I actually met her in the home that he was raised in partially.
So you mentioned buying a home, and this was kind of a question I was going to ask you later. Did he do that after he was in the service? Did he use the
Yes.
GI Bill to help?
See, I never heard. I don't know if it was a GI Bill, but he was not a big spender. And so he miraculously saved, put money aside, and took care of his family.
If this would have been when in the late 40s,
Yes.
it was probably the G. Well. That'd be interesting. Do you know how his mother reacted when he told her he was going to enlist?
Well, I know that there are articles to this day that they have in the library of him. The family was proud of him being a Marine. I mean, even like his different promotions, they have, how he returned home whenever there was the high school reunions, they wrote it up in the, it was this big thing for Bath, Maine, for him to come back. So somehow that family was just a very well-known and prominent family in the city with how they did things. But again, there's not a lot because he was a man of few words.
But he was always very, very proud of his like of his service and of being a Marine. I mean, that was anyone who met him within moments knew he was a Marine, and the pride he had around that. And his generosity was also just something that everyone could see. So I'm not surprised that he would save his money and buy a home for his family, and he would be generous in many other ways to people he didn't even know.
Yeah. He was a man that was a t-shirt man. I mean, unless he was in formals, for the military for something, he was a t-shirt man in shorts and was a swimmer, sang and all the and he retired in Hawaii. So he was well known in all the bars, and they always requested for him to sing. And even I have seen, as I've gone through some of his records, at some of the Marine Corps events that they would have, he would sing for those things as well.
You know, it was a difficult time for African Americans in the 40s. And it said that Black soldiers, also Marines, had to fight a two-front battle, victory from the enemies without and victory over enemies at home. So it was kind of an act of valor to join the Marines. I understand that he wanted to help his family, but going into entering the service during wartime still took a lot of courage. What do you think made him special? Not everybody did that. He volunteered to go into the Marines. Is that correct?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so not everybody did that. A lot of people had to be drafted to go into, well, you weren't, I don't think you ever get drafted into the Marines. You get drafted in the Army. But he joined the Marines, and knowing that he put his life at risk. What do you think made him special? Any of you, any thoughts on that?
He was a very principled man, and he believed in helping people. There was no one he did not know. It didn't matter what background. And so that probably threw a lot of people off that weren't African American. But there was no one he did not know. And as I being raised with him, he would even bring the especially Black men or their wives when if they were struggling, and was really committed to help them in their service to be successful.
Yeah, and I think that his unique experience of being in Bath, Maine, and being, I think his experience of being treated, and whatever level of respect you can have being Black in that time period, there was a level of respect that he experienced in his family in Bath, Maine, that once he left there, and other places probably didn't experience it the same way. And I know one of the things I'd always been a little bit surprised about and never fully understood is he seemed to not want to entertain that entertain like a conversation about racism. He didn't actually he didn't he didn't dive into with us, and I always felt like he wanted to kind of show that he was just the same as everybody else. And I don't know, I don't know how to articulate that better, but he seemed to like he didn't want to talk about those things and wanted to be prove that
You can
he
rise
was the
above,
same.
you know,
He can rise
like
up.
he, yeah, like he's strong and, you know, in the midst of all the obstacles he has to face, he always did well and succeeded. And I feel like that runs through mom's bloodline, which then goes to us, you know. Our mom, she coached us in track, you know, and so much of the success that we have, I feel like it was very militant, you know, mom were with us. And so I definitely know that that was because of how you know, military.
He was an equal. People might have looked at him as not being equal, but he never saw himself as not being as equal to any other man.
Okay, and that was what I was going to ask, that whether or not his perspective was kind of a outward or inward, that in facing the world, you know, he was did not he didn't kind of subscribe to racism as something you could not overcome. But then sometimes you have a conversation with the rest of the world, and then within your family, you kind of recognize the existence of certain things. And so I was just curious as to how that played itself out. But
You know, I always thought, Doc, that it was interesting because even when I was in high school, he would bring the grunts. He was the one that he oversaw the grunts that when they went to war, they are the first ones. The Marines are the ones who hit the ground first and clear the way for all the other.
You were anticipating my next question. I was going to ask you about that because you
Yeah.
mentioned that he was a
And you
grunt.
know, yes. And the thing is how unique this my dad was, because I never heard my dad swear. That was not in our home. My mother was a queen. She was treated highly by him and respected. And I remember when he would bring the grunts to our home and we would host them, they would always come up to me and says, "Is this really your dad?" And I says, "What do you mean? Why are you asking these questions?" And they say, "This is not the man we know." And that's how I found out that his mouth was foul, that he had this hard, you know, tough personality. And I'm thinking, you can ask the girls, did grandpa ever come across that way? Never.
Nope.
You would have, I would have fought them if they would have told me my dad was like that. I says, "That is not my dad. I don't know who you're talking about." And I remember my father clearly telling me, and maybe it was my mom that told me, that when he was at work, he was at work. But when he was home, he cut off work and he was with family.
And he seemed also more likely to talk to people who were outside of the family about his life than even our family. The first time I started like overhearing things about grandpa's life or his experiences was when I had a friend come over and visit, and he took my friend outside to walk through photos, old photos and conversation. And same once I got married, he took my husband out and met with him and talked with him, but he didn't want to talk about his experiences often with family for some reason. But
any sense of why that was?
That's a good question. It was very, very difficult. He was a very, like I said, loving and accepting, but he did not talk about those experiences. The only military experience that I remember is when we transferred from Arlington, Virginia to Camp Pendleton out in Oceanside, California, his last assignment. And I remember my mom saying, you know, at Camp Pendleton is one of the largest military bases. And so they do a lot of military training. So you could hear like bombs or you know, would even shake the homes that were near it and stuff. And I remember my mother saying that when he came back from Vietnam, that there were times that she can remember, she kind of walked up behind him and he almost killed her because there's just the automatic reaction from coming from Vietnam. And saying that he, you know, he was in bed one night and all of a sudden there was the bed shook and he hit the ground, the floor, and, you know, in a panic. But those were life-saving modes from being in the different wars. So he definitely had, what is that? PTSD. PTSD. Yes.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. And again, 3 years in the military, three different conflict zones. I understand that he had an opportunity to be a general, but declined. Well, tell me about that and his decision.
Yes, I wondered about that too. At the same time that he was asked, my parents were going through a divorce. And I asked him, I says, "Dad, why didn't you accept that? It was such a high honor." And at that time, I think there had only been one black general before then. And he just said, "If I cannot control my family, how can I lead a country?" And I just thought, okay.
You don't have any thoughts on that decision by your grandfather?
It's interesting because he, even though he didn't talk a lot about himself and his experiences, we all knew how much he loved my grandmother and had opportunities to marry again and chose not to. You know, as he talked about her, it was always with like respect and admiration. And so I imagine he was just very much hurting during that time. And mm-hmm. what I would imagine it's a reflection of. And also, although I think Grandpa had so much pride in his accomplishments to that point, he had made it. So he was very accomplished at already, right? And so that's a that's my thoughts on that. I don't know, Alyssa, if you have any other thoughts or Bree.
Yeah, I feel like it really shows like Grandpa's integrity in that he holds himself to the same standards. I feel that himself to the same standards he would hold other people. And I think that, I don't know, you know, in higher positions, you know what it takes and what it means. And I think that I agree that he was hurting, but I feel like Grandpa was being honest and real with himself. And it's like, nah, but for real though, like, you know, this is a real thing to keep together, and I don't take it lightly.
And I'd also maybe, I mean, I obviously didn't know him, but a lot of times it's that nuclear family that helps a person in his capacity to be able to be successful. That whole, the nuclear family and the spouse helps to keep all those pieces together. So,
yeah, you know, she was a graduate of Howard University.
We're going to get to your mom in a minute. We're going to get to mom.
But I was just going to say that her accomplishments really aided to the types of things that he did, and being an advocate for women, especially the women of color on the military basis, and even when she was in the government.
Okay. So I'm interested in any stories that William shared about his time in the service, any adventures, painful, scary, or funny memories? Any little tidbits that he told you?
So we grew up stateside, and by the time we came on the scene, he was retired in Hawaii. And so unfortunately, we didn't have that. We didn't have the privilege of really doing life with him. So when we did get to visit, it felt very much like a vacation bubble in my memory.
Can't imagine why being in Hawaii would feel like a vacation, though.
Or even, you
and
know,
he paid for everything. He didn't want us to pay for anything.
Yeah, always really generous. But I think that context lends itself to kind of being present in the moment. And so there's not as many stories that I personally have of him really talking about the past, but he would be really present. And there were times where we went on base and visited different spots. I'm trying to remember, Mom, the names of those places. They're not coming to my memory right now. Danelle, maybe you remember when we were there, or Bree. Like I remember the big ships we were on, but it was very much like, yeah. But he was trying to make experiences for us. Like, it was very clear to me that my joy mattered to him. And wanting to enjoy time with me and my sisters and my family, and catering to us constantly, and money's not a thing. And so those are the memories that I have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He was very, very proud of his grandchildren. And he wasn't, like I said, he was a man of few words. So if he said that he was proud, even of the men that they married, you know, I remember asking for our daughters to go with their husbands. I wanted my father to meet the men that they married, because that was, he could see who they were, what type of men they were. And how were they going to take care of his grandkids? And so yeah. But he just, you know, I've heard other families just say, you know, their person in the military did not speak much. And my father just did not talk about his service. You know, I remember growing up and going to in Arlington, Virginia, to parades and how exact and how beautiful they were done. But that's it.
But, you know, I think one of the things I remember, although he didn't talk about it, what I saw was him spending a lot of time with other former Marines, you know, with other Marines, right? Yes. He spent his days hanging out with people who were in the Marines or military where they had conversations and connection. And you know, it was obviously such an like critical part of his life, even post, you know, after retirement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have, and my memory too, I'm the baby, so I, you know, have fewer interactions, but I know he specifically came to your graduation. Like, he would not leave Hawaii at all, but he was like, for you. And I remember spending a lot of time with him during that time. And because he was so proud. For Danelle's graduation of college, yeah.
And I think I remember at that time kind of wondering, like, why is this such a big deal for him? And it's this legacy, the history of just all of, just knowing that it wasn't common, and it was a legacy he wanted to leave of his grandchildren and his children, you know, being able to graduate from college and do well in life was just like a testament to him as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, Lorna, you and I talked about this earlier. I've talked to a number of descendants of soldiers and Marines, and the common theme is that they didn't really talk a whole lot. I know my dad was in Korea, the Korean conflict, and he never really talked about service. My mother, on the other hand, from her time in the Women's Army Corps, she talked all the time. she was just the opposite of almost everybody I've talked all the time, thousands of pictures. And what did your dad do when he completed military service? I know he moved to Hawaii, but
enjoyed life. He
volunteered.
He did volunteer work in the hospital.
Okay.
There. But he spent time talking, and like one the girl said already, being with other military men and it just enjoyed life. You know, at one point I do remember him saying that he says, I think people thought I was the mayor of Honolulu because the way he was treated and wherever he would go, he was known. He was just, like I said, he was a person that he knew you, even though he didn't know you. So, and
that familiarity with everyone.
Yes.
And he kept himself right. He was like lifting weights up until the end.
That man,
he was rich.
His blues that he came into service with,
he could still wear.
Proud that he could wear them at 87 years old.
As we're just talking about this, and I'm thinking just how intentional he was about the image that he portrayed to his family, to others. And, you know, I think it was an authentic image, but it was also one that was very, very strong, very put together. He had no faults. Like, he was, and I think that probably couldn't have been the whole truth. And I think part of the not talking about his past and his experiences, I imagine, were, you know, those were maybe painful parts, but also parts that weren't pretty, and it didn't fit the image that he wanted us to know about him, and maybe the image he wanted others to know.
Hmm. He would cook for people. He would He was known to be a no-nonsense man. You didn't mess with Sergeant Major Tenney. And but I always heard the grunt say, but he's fair. He was a no-nonsense man, but he's fair.
Do you recall any lessons that he learned through his time in the service that he passed on to the family? Any values that you think are associated with that?
I learned how to cook with Spam. he taught me some recipes.
I have a couple. One is, I remember we were visiting as a family, and he lived in a kind of condo style apartment near Waikiki Beach. And I had gone into the kitchen and pulled down a glass and accidentally bumped another one, and it shattered. And Grandpa was very meticulous and clean. And I remember my mom telling us, you know, you make your bed, anything you pull out, you put back. I remember before we left the last time, we had to clean really good. So I was legit scared. So I picked up the pieces of this shattered glass and I put them in the trash can and tried to put some other stuff on top of it to hide it in the trash can. Well, I don't know if he actually saw it and just played it off to see if I would tell the truth, but later he came and he said, Alyssa, I'm missing a glass. And I didn't say anything. I was like deciding, you know, am I going to lie in this moment or not? And I ended up saying, I broke it. And he said, you never hide what you do. Don't hide what you do. And I never forgot that. I mean, there's that kind of sense of conviction and integrity, even in that moment, as probably what a 9-year-old, like that really stuck with me. And then later in life, another thing that stuck with me is in the spiritual sense. We grew up in a very evangelical Christian home. And I remember kind of coming of age and questioning some theology around Christianity and this idea of sin and atonement and forgiveness and Jesus Christ. And my mom had mentioned one time that Grandpa had, in sharing her faith with Grandpa, that he had mentioned, and Mom, correct me if I'm remembering this wrong, but that he felt like he had done some things that were so bad that they were unforgivable. And I remember thinking, I don't know if God could fault us for feeling a sense of unworthiness, you know, like that felt very spiritual and deep to me. It actually, like, to me, it revealed Grandpa never wanted to talk much about faith. He wasn't very interested in religion, which was very central to our home. He kept it very in the moment, very present, very secular. But for me to hear that statement, it was impressionable on me in my own spiritual life, because it showed that I had I was still a part of a legacy of a grandfather that was aware of who he was, aware of his faults, and still had a respect for a perfect God, in a sense, whether he articulated it as like that or not. So those are two things that stick with me.
I remember being taught how to fold things. You know, and that was definitely the military way.
Fold things and make the bed, right?
And, you know, making the beds and, you know, cleanliness, being neat. Now, on the outside, you may come to my home, it may look neat, but don't open certain closets. You know what that's like. But, he was a very disciplined man. He was a very disciplined man. And I would say I learned, as far as caring for my body, my temple, this temple that I'm to be a steward of, being highly responsible for that. He lived that all of his life. And it wasn't a pride, but it was like, you know, it allowed for him to do the things that he enjoyed doing. He was a swimmer. He used to swim channels. You know, how many blacks during that time was even swimming, much less competing, where you would swim 6 to 8 miles like that? He loved it. And like the girl said, I mean, I think his thighs were the size, his calves were the size of our thighs, and his thighs were just enormous. And, you know, I mean, and even at 87, his body was a specimen.
So William had three sisters and an older brother.
Yes.
What do you know about his siblings?
Not much at all. He didn't talk about his family.
Do you know if any of them served in the military?
No, they didn't.
Okay. So now we're going to get back to his wife, your mom, and grandma. She was a management analyst at the Pentagon, which sounds like pretty interesting work. How did they meet? And then tell me about her work.
Now that is one story that grandpa would share with me. Because as I said, he's from Bath, Maine. So there was nothing but white women there. So when he went to the service, it must have been around 1948. So my mom was at Howard University. So he went to some kind of party at this black historical school. And he says, I went into this party and I never seen so many beautiful black women like that before. And he says, and I laid eyes on your mom and that was it. And so it was a year later that they got married, actually, at the little, you know, I happened to find it. Alyssa is a graduate of Howard University as well.
HU?
Yeah.
Well, as are both of my parents and my sister and a bunch of cousins. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And
down the line.
And you're, as we talked before.
Wait a minute, Doc.
Go ahead, sorry.
Wait a minute, Doc. They got married at the little chapel at Howard University there. So
Rankin.
I don't know, huh? If the little
Rankin Chapel.
Yeah, they got married there. And I have this picture of them standing there. So, yeah.
So was your mom an AKA also?
AKA, yes, she was.
So I was going to segue to you. You
put the AKA.
I was going to say that when you and I talked a week or so ago, your mother and my mother were both at Howard around the same time. So
they might have known each other.
My dad was there also then. So you're a Howard alum as well and a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated. Tell me about your interesting athletic and career backgrounds. Lorna?
Well, when I moved from Arlington, Virginia, I found even the certificate. My mother was this sophisticated woman, and so she was determined I was going to be a pianist. So I actually have this certificate from Howard University where I took piano lessons for 5 years or so, and they thought I was going to be this amazing pianist. And, you know, that was during Motown and all that, and I'm like, playing Bach and Chopin and all that. It was like, it was just driven by my mom. So when we moved from Arlington, Virginia to Oceanside to Camp Pendleton, girl, she couldn't find anything like that. I'm saying hallelujah. So my 10th grade teacher, I was in 10th grade, and she says, I think you have some athletic ability. Why don't you come out to the AAU? So I did. And that was the track team. And from 10th grade on, I was a hurdler. I just naturally took to it. In 71, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico for the Olympic training camp. And it just seemed like it just kind of skyrocketed. And so, and being in Oceanside at that time, and a lot smaller city at the time, the Tribune there, there's all kind of articles that were there. And at one point before the, I was in the Hall of Fame in the San Diego Museum, but they had a fire. And so a lot of the stuff got burned there, but it was exciting. I was the top four in the United States and represented the United States over in Russia in 1973. And it was an exciting life. I was in college at that time. So,
but you were also in Munich, the famous 1970.
I was an alternate for the Olympics. And at that time, the alternate, you went to the Olympic training camp and hope somebody broke a leg or did something. And then you were able to fit in. So it was like, you know, so close, but no cigar, as the saying goes.
And so after Howard, what'd you do after Howard?
I know. Alyssa is the one who went to Howard University.
So, Lorna, you did not go to Howard? Did I get?
No, I went to San Diego State University.
Okay, so after you finished San Diego State University.
I went into ministry.
Okay.
Yeah, I went into ministry full time and began to work with college students to talk about a relationship with Christ. And the amazing part was, because it was so fresh, my name was well known, Lorna Tenney, that any of the campuses that I went on in the Midwest is where I was at Michigan State and others, that the coaches would let me come right in because of my name as a world-class athlete. So it was just amazing. I didn't even think about it until they said, oh my goodness, yeah, you can just talk to whoever you want.
And so you're coaching high school track now?
Yes, I am. I work with urban high school athletes, with a focus with those that are homeless. And it's amazing, you know, that's it's a phenomenon that is around the country, homelessness. And I run these numbers by because I want people to understand the magnitude of homelessness. We have 21 schools in our county. And out of those 21 schools, we have just over 6,000 from 9th to 12th grade that are homeless high school.
Isn't it extraordinary that in the wealthiest country in the history of mankind that these things, conditions exist? So you have three accomplished daughters who've graciously joined us tonight. Thank you again. So why don't you tell me about your educational background, your careers? Want to start with Danelle, since you're the...
She's the oldest.
Oldest.
Yeah, I went to University of Minnesota for my bachelor's, and I spent time I started out my career at Target, and also spent time, I ran a painting business for a short bit, but I really have always been passionate about making an impact in communities. No figure, you go figure. I've got, you know, my mother, and grandfather here, but I really wanted to make an impact in communities of color, underserved communities. And so I wanted to do that through business. And so I went to business school. I went to Harvard Business School, and came out working in economic development. I also worked in education. I worked in talent development, and I now work in kidney care and work in health equity, trying to address disparities there.
Okay. And you're the mother of four precious... You have three. Sorry.
Yes, I have a great husband and three lovely kids, 8, 6, and 3. keep us busy.
I was getting ready to say, nothing to do there, right? So Alyssa?
Yeah. I work in publishing by day. I'm a writer by night. But books and words have always been pretty deep-seated in what I'm doing. I went to Howard University for undergrad and studied journalism with an advertising emphasis, which brought me into marketing and eventually ad writing and copywriting for small agencies, which I did as a sole proprietor for about a decade after retail marketing. And then did a career pivot over the last handful of years and went back for my MFA in children's literature. And so I work for a company that has several imprints. One is children's, one is adult nonfiction, one is scholarly. And I straddle the lines there, working in publicity and marketing.
Where'd you get your MFA?
Hamline University here in Minnesota.
Yep, I've heard of it.
I did get my, digital publishing and editing at University of Chicago and got my certification so that I could do freelance work when I was popping the babies out.
That's important.
Yeah. So we have four. 11 is our oldest and 6 is our youngest. And
another busy household.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of writing? What's your genre?
I focus on children's literature. I do picture books all the way to YA novels. And my emphasis is really multiracial, cross-cultural friendships. And so writing for that next generation of students that are navigating racialization and all the implications of it, even though we like to pretend we're in a post-race world.
Well, we used to pretend that. I think the last few years have cured us of that affliction.
Perhaps. So, yes. Perhaps.
All right, Brielle?
Yes, I am a hairstylist, and I live in New York City, and I guess we're saying our stories. What are the things we've done? I actually am an alumni of San Diego State as well, my mother's school, alma mater. And that was really nice to kind of follow in her footsteps, even though school looked a little different during that time. But, you know, she ran with the La Jolla Demons, and because they didn't have a women's track team.
Okay.
And so I feel like it was my job as the next generation. They only have a women's track team there. And I was a part of that and got a full ride scholarship. In high school, my mother coached me as well in Florida, and I won state my junior year.
Woo-hoo.
So that got me the full ride scholarship to go to San Diego State University.
What event?
100 meter hurdles. Yes, okay. That's our babies. So I tried to steer away from it because, you know, my middle sister Alyssa ran as well and everything. So, we just all happened to be good at it. So that was really nice and brought me along my journey. And in the midst of all of that, I always did hair and was creative. After graduation, I transferred to Clemson in South Carolina. And so that's actually where I got some even more training in track. And then after graduating from Clemson, moved to New York to do hair. So I've been pursuing hair and cosmetology for about 12 years now. And I have my own hair salon and shop in Queens. So it's been going well. It's been really amazing. And coming from my grandfather actually helped support my cosmetology education. And so that really was major to coming from college and then not having to pay for another set of education was a big blessing. So that's where I'm at.
So now all three of you runners?
I am a runner and was a runner. My mother coached me as well in high school, and then I ran track at Howard on scholarship.
Okay, Danelle?
We also won state in Minnesota.
Yeah, so I run if I'm running from something or
don't listen to her. She just got done with a 5K and she's trying to do another one when she comes and visits me this summer. So it's deep in there. It's deep in there.
So you know, even when she was a little girl, Danelle, she was the businesswoman. You know, she was selling or making or doing something as a little girl. So
I think Brianna was like that.
Yeah, Brianna was always been the entrepreneur, but I was always organizing stuff and telling people what to do.
I was going to say, Danelle's been managing stuff. Bree's been the business hustler.
Yeah. I've been selling made things since I was born. I made cookies and went door to door. Danelle, for her wedding, she color coded everyone's job on Excel sheet. So it was very successful. Amen to the military way of doing things, is all I can say.
And God bless your dad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had definitely four powerhouse women.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about legacy and influence. I'm wondering, wondering how Williams' experiences in the Montreport Marine influenced and helped shape your life, your lives, and your decisions. I mean, Lorna, you'd probably be the most obviously the most direct.
No, don't let anyone or anything try to tell you what you cannot do. And he was definitely a man who stood for what he believed in. He was a principled man, and he stood, whether it was right or wrong for anyone else, if that's what he where he was, he stood his ground, and he didn't budge. So I think that's one of the things, and that people were people. And that's hard to understand, because the atrocities that were done to our Black men during that time, and even today, and for him to say, people are people, Lorna. You need to treat them the way you want to be treated.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was, graduated from high school, I saved up money so that from working in the summers, I saved up money so I could go to Hawaii to be with him as like a gift to myself after high school graduation. And I think for me, there's a couple of things. One was just joy. I just felt like a ton of, he just lived his life with a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. And thinking about when I retire, the way that I want to live is to be able to do all the things that give me joy. And then I think the other echoes my mom, which is just the way that he just treated people. And he had super high expectations of respect, that you respect everyone, and an intolerance for disrespect. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And you know, you would know when Bill was in the house, because he's had this big, boisterous laugh. He loved to laugh, and he just enjoyed himself. Like Danelle said, once he retired, he enjoyed whatever it was. That was his time.
Well, that's encouraging. I need to think about more about that.
You know, you asked the question as far as what things would we live with, but you know, Alyssa, with us having before my dad died, he kept saying, talking about this award, and he wanted to make sure he got it, but I couldn't understand what he was referring to. And I'm, to this day, I'm so thankful. You know, I find myself talking to him and saying, Dad, I'm so glad you didn't get it, because what it has, the pride it has given my daughters.
I was getting ready to ask you that. Yes.
Yes. The pride it's given our daughters. And, you know, and they just said, well, Grandpa Tenney was a badass, you know. It's like, we aren't a family that swears, but they were just the pride and the knowing, and that to this point, we think he might be the highest ranked Marine that came from the
Point.
Yes. And so, and how not only him, but the men that came from there were so honored by August 25th. You know, 1923, when we went there as a family.
To Jacksonville, North Carolina.
Yes, to Jacksonville. Just gave us such a great respect. And so much so, you know, Alyssa, she was on a plane. And you can kind of explain it, Alyssa, but she was so filled going back on a plane and just reminiscing of all that had just taken place to lift up not only our family legacy, but so many others that have been tried to be stamped out of history. And so, Alyssa, I'll let you share a little bit of that.
Yeah, I can share the poem. And just as preface to that, I mean, I don't think it would have meant any less to me to have Grandpa there. I coveted the idea of him being there, especially looking around at the congressional ceremony when we were in Jacksonville and seeing the men who were alive and were able to have their families around them. I very much wish that that could have been a possibility for us. Nonetheless, yeah, I was on the plane and wrote this on my phone, and I titled it 20,000 Semper Fi, and I shared it with my family, and then that's when my mom said, you need to write this down, or share it, you know, write it down and share it with us, and then Danelle corrected all my typos.
The manager.
I think Bree corrected them too, actually. They teamed up on me. All right. 20,000 Semper Fi. Once upon a time, there was a country, there was a war, there was a draft, and there was a line drawn bold with hate that said black ink couldn't defend the white story, even though they used black ink to write it. Said black men couldn't be Marines, couldn't be the warrior elite of the military. But the fairy tale didn't go as planned. America wasn't winning. America was scared. America was desperate. So they turned to their eager shadows begrudgingly. Some as young as 14, lying about their age to save the freedom of a generation choosing to fight. Marched their prickly chins and home-cooked hearts through Montford Point, trained in despicable conditions, trained by men who hated them, trained in a game they were meant to lose. But their black shadows grew tall with the sun shining on them, and they stayed. They chose to slowly smudge away the bold line with their valor, with their own kind of desperation, slowly chipping away at cement that held the pillars of the White House unmovable in its racism, while black hands swayed the United States flag on hills of victory, saving America from its enemies, saving America from itself. 20,000 warriors over 7 years to convince President Truman that the line should have never been there in the first place. My grandfather was among them, William Bill Tinney. Demanded to defend his country, demanded the right to fight, climbed the ranks to the highest there is, sergeant, major, wrapped in the flag when he died. Only half his story remembered, Montford Point erased. The story of the first voluntary 20,000 Black Marines who fought for the right to fight, erased. The base renamed, the hate untold, only the victory celebrated. Until children and grandchildren stepped up, until love made demands, and now 3,000 families of America's heroes have been found. The Congressional Gold Medal of Honor placed in the hands of their children who hold their dignity, who tell their story, who make them live on. Only 17,000 more to go. Semper Fi.
That's awesome.
Thank you. I will say I wrote this poem from a place of rage, and even that line in there where it says, you know, they fought with their own kind of desperation. I think I wrote this poem with my own kind of desperation to make sense of it all. I think the weight and to understand the hate that was the backdrop of Montford Point. But I think that what's so beautiful about Grandpa's story and even what Mom was saying is how Grandpa still showed respect for all persons, and that included white people. And he never had this like anti-America sentiment or anti-government sentiment. He was very patriotic. And for me, that just blows my mind. Like, I'm not in his shoes at all and a step removed and barely hanging on to my melanin. And I'm angry on the plane, you know? So I think it just shows really the utmost awe.
So did going back
for Grandpa.
Was it being in that physical setting of Montfort Point that, I mean, I've not been there. I plan to go over this summer. I'm going to go in August when they do it again this year. Was that environment that kind of?
That's a good question. You know, inspired that's a really you. Great question. Because what, you know, the ceremony in and of itself, I didn't have that rage. The rage came after when they brought us on base to see the museum.
Yes.
And they're starting, you know, I'm unraveling the history and the backdrop of all these photos. And I'm thinking about kind of this broader landscape of what was happening in the war in America's stance and position toward these men who are fighting. And that's where the rage came from. Like, it's so beautiful and so maddening at all the same time.
Yeah. You know, the slogan that they kept saying is, these men, they fought for the right to fight.
Yeah, that's...
It's like a two battles going on at the same time.
You see, you know, whenever I interview anybody, I always ask that question about talk about what was going on at that time. And it's still extraordinary to me, whether it was the Marines, the Army, the Women's Army Corps, that people, particularly when people volunteer to go to war for a country that cannot stand their very sight.
Right.
And to do so and still love that country.
Right.
It's just crazy. It's just hard to fathom, you know.
But there's that one side, that commitment, that my part of my generation, the next generation, that I'm going to pave a way for them.
Mm-hmm.
But even though you think of that, still how to not to have a hate towards the very one that made it so difficult for you.
Yeah, because I mean, all of my parents and all five uncles on collected on both sides, everybody was in the service, and no one felt any hatred or disdain for the country at all. Mm-hmm. It is extraordinary. I mean, having grown up in the Vietnam era, where people have a whole lot of feelings about a lot of things,
so
how was William when he passed?
He was 87.
Okay. And is he interred at a veteran cemetery?
He is in the Arlington Cemetery. Yes, he is.
All right. We're going to have to. And so are my parents. That, yeah. So yeah. We're.
And that was the other thing, too. I think to recognize what he had accomplished as a sergeant major and a Black Marine. He had the full ceremony. So our family, you know, I think we marched for about a mile, but he was on the cart, just the band, just everything that was done, the guns, it was just laid out, just how we were treated even as a family. What were you going to say, Danelle?
Oh, no, I was just saying it like the salute and it was the whole thing.
Yeah.
The 21 gun salute.
Yeah.
But the 21 gun, but even as we were walking, that there were people, when his carriage, people stopped. So they knew that this was a high ranked person, and they would stop if they weren't military. They stopped and respect, and all the military would salute. Mm-hmm. And it was such precision for it all. The Marine Corps band. That played and all, and then the guns that went off. But even just the very beginning, how they took our family in and how they cared for us and just how they walk precisely. It's this protection of you. So and then, like I said, then to come and to see this high award given to him in honoring this labor that he gave. And he loved, he was, as he says, I'm a Marine till death. You know, he was proud of what he had done. Or I should say, he was proud to be a Marine. I'll say that. I don't know about what he had done, but he was proud to be a Marine.
So please share any reflections on what his life and legacy mean to you and family? Danelle, you want to take that one first?
Yeah, and I definitely want my sisters to share too, Bree. I think for me, it's just a reminder that, you know, I stand on the shoulders of so many, but my grandfather represents so much of that, and the difficulties that he went through and persevered, and the humility of that. I think for me, I'm still in shock of all the things that I didn't know, and how humbled and honored and proud I was to uncover and learn the things that I have since he's passed, and wanting to take that legacy forward. And it all of a sudden gives me this sense of, wait, if this is what he did, what can I do? And how can I take this? You know, this is in my blood, right? To make a difference and to change the trajectory of the world by one small act. That's a huge act. And so what's mine to leave, and what's ours as a family to leave. So that's what I think about.
Melissa?
Yeah, I would echo everything Danelle just said. And then another practical way that grandpa's influenced me is that in my children's literature, I have a theme of ancestral spirit and the power of ancestral guidance in children. And I think I didn't intentionally make that a theme. It started coming over the last few years. And I know a story that I just finished up and have been querying was very impacted by my experience in Jacksonville.
Okay. Riel?
I would say, you know, for me, like, my grandfather's work ethic affects me a lot. And I'm going to be honest, I think there's a things I didn't realize were affecting me, but they were in track and running, and the kind of discipline that came with that, which was also fed from my mother, which was fed to her from my grandfather. I would say that kind of work ethic has gone into the way I live my life and my career. And especially as an entrepreneur, and specifically working with natural hair, it's a sport, you know, and it takes diligence, and it takes compassion, and it takes love, and it takes an understanding of our history. And so I really just appreciate seeing my grandfather and how hard he's worked. And I feel it as a relay, quite literally. My mom, I actually have his hat that he, right, is it a hat? What do we call it? No, the military cap. And quite literally, when I feel like I'm weak or I want to give up, I put it on. And my grandmother also, she has like this really pretty silky robe that I got from their storage unit. And I put that robe on and I wear his hat and I pray to them and I ask them to give me their strength. And I'm like, I feel like maybe I'm going through the same things you went through. So like, help us out. I love that. So I would say that is definitely, I quite literally bring him into my life. And wear him on my crown to give me strength.
Isn't it a blessing to have been able to grow up around your grandparents? You know, a lot of kids don't have that opportunity. So I think that's a blessing.
Definitely.
So I just
a blessing that was an unsung hero.
Yeah.
Exactly. But we sung his praise. And you know, if you can't tell, you can't see the whole house, but she's a daddy's girl. And she she always will be, you know? So we sing his praise.
I just have a few more questions to wrap up tonight. So what do you think about Williams' decision to serve his country, given the level of racism that existed at that time?
His family was far more important than race issues.
Do you think that he, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, do you think that he would make that decision now? If he could see the nation now, do you think he'd make the same decision to serve the country?
It's in his blood.
Yes.
It is who he is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what lessons from his life story can you share to inspire young African Americans to embrace fear as opportunity so they can, you know, try to shadow those glass ceilings and be the best that they can be, mm-hmm. and be the best selves. Yeah. Any lessons for another generation?
Go ahead.
I don't think he was thinking about breaking glass ceilings. I think that he was taking what he thought was the best step for him. And he did it even in the face of adversity, mm-hmm. you know, of what he knew would be difficult, the racism that he most certainly had to experience. And he did it anyways. And I think one is when you know the right thing to do, do it even when it's hard. And mm-hmm. and then I think the other is that if you're always focused on what's going to hold you back and hold you down, it probably will. Mm-hmm. And nice. I think he was really intentional about not focusing on what was going to hold him back and focused on building the relationships with people, understanding, like learning them and being his best and that kind of propelling him forward. I actually remember him talking about you not focusing on the negative. And I saw him do that in his life, and he had to do that in his career.
And he believed in bringing people up with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't have to do that in his career. He chose to do that. He chose to do it, yes. Because other people, not everybody exercised that same option. I'm sorry, Lorna, I interrupted you.
No, I'm just agreeing with you.
Alyssa, did you have anything you want to add to that?
I mean, I feel like the times that I felt closest to him, he just knew how to have such a good time. And in light of all the hard, right, in the background that he had and the racism that he had to have been facing, whether he spoke to it or not all the time, it's a reminder to me that the world can make me hard, but I have the option to stay soft. And that I can still choose joy and I can still be happy. I mean, even his choice of retirement, he wanted to live someplace and he made it happen. He wanted years to let his hair down and he made it happen. Mm-hmm. And he still figured out a way to balance and give back and bring meaning to his life, but still claim the peace that he wanted. And that speaks to me deeply. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just going to say, after the Vietnam War, they called it R&R, rest and restoration.
Recuperation.
Yeah. And my mom joined my dad in Hawaii. And I remember him always saying, we had such a fabulous time together as a family. I was a young teen. And he says, this is where I'm going to retire. And that's what he did. He held on to that and he retired. When you were speaking, Alyssa, all of a sudden I reflected and remembered him saying that.
That's great.
Well, Lorna, Danelle, Alyssa, and Rael, thank you so much for joining tonight and sharing your family story. I really am very grateful. Jewel took the time to join us.
Thank you for making this space.
Yes. Thank you for helping us to reflect again and remember.
To my audience, thank you for listening to episode 40 of Next Us 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. Tonight, I'm adding a special note about episode 40 that was requested by the Johnson family. The recorded content of this episode is approved for use on the Next Us 818 podcast only. Reuse and or repurposing of this interview for other media appropriation, including selling of this interview content, is not permissible without the written consent of the Johnson family. As you all know now, I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I will share a quote from Aaron Matlock. There are people you meet who become impossible to forget. They were not sent to you by accident, but instead destined to open the doorway to a different version of your life. See you guys for our next show on Wednesday, May the 1st at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, New York City Podcast Network, Spotify for Podcasters, and YouTube Music.